Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted today to be joined by Shamil and Kavi Thakra, the co-founders of the restaurant group Dishoom. Inspired by the cafes of early 20th century Bombay, their restaurants have reinvigorated Indian food in the UK. Their new book, Dishoom, From Bombay With Love, is out now. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
So we'll start where we always start, at the very beginning. Your cousins, first of all.
Indeed.
You both grew up in London, is that right?
More or less, actually. I suppose we...
We are definitely cousins, not more or less cousins.
Yeah. We're more and less cousins, yeah. We grew up in Leicester for a bit as well, and,
okay.
then in London.
But were you both in the same place at the same time?
Yes.
10 years apart.
Yes, well, we're 10 years apart, but we grew up in the same house.
So tell us about that. What was food like when you were growing up, 10 years apart?
I mean, it's a joint family, and I guess, and I'm sure, Kavi, I don't know if this is true for you, but I remember always a table replete with food. And especially our grandmother was always in the, she was always cooking up a storm, and she was always cooking everything for everyone that was really difficult and involved, and there would be loads of people around, there would be a table full of food. And that is my memory of sort of food in our family, where it was a real way to bring the family together.
Yeah. Every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And then at the weekends, our weekend meal was a huge deal as well.
And what were the kind of classic dishes that you'd be eating?
Well, it was funny because my grandma always used to, on the weekends, do puris, which are a delicious Indian bread, and potato shak, which again is just a delicious home-style potato curry. And we used to eat that with hot tea, and we used to dunk our puris in our tea, which is just a delicious way to enjoy both things.
And jalebi, they're sort of fried. Everything was fried. So puris are deep-fried. Yeah. Jalebis are, again, a sort of sweet,
deep-fried sugar and flour.
Yeah. And then hot chai. I just remember, very, very traditional Gujarati breakfast.
And were you good eaters when you were little, or were the things that you turned down from your grandmother's table?
I, funnily enough, used to eat everything. I had an aversion as a youngster to okra, which has since changed. And I had a harder time with aubergine. But again, now I love both those things.
I don't know. I wasn't much good. But because it was a joint family, Govey's mum was around a lot when I was young. And I remember Govey's mum used to make us eat stuff that we didn't eat for dinner for breakfast.
Yeah.
So we got to eat
everything.
A
really good tactic.
Yeah, yeah.
You quickly learn to like those things and have them hot and fresh.
I don't know if she'll be glad that I mentioned that.
And did you learn to cook when you were little?
Yeah, I think we did. I mean, my mum taught me a decent number of dishes. We certainly were made to help out in the kitchen and do chopping and do cooking. I think I got taught
to cook at home as well as at school. I had cookery lessons from 9 years old at school. And then as I got older as well, I did cookery lessons at a bigger school as well. So it was something that I always loved, was being around food and feeding others. And so
we normally ask at this point, you know, what is it that gave you your love of food? But it sounds quite clearly like you were in a family that was going to instill that real passion, enthusiasm for home-cooked food from the get-go.
I think that's right. I think that the two of us, Kavi is the bigger foodie, I would say. And I think I'm very interested in the cultural aspects of what we do and the sort of bringing alive India and Bombay specifically. I love all that. But Kavi has a really, really good nose for all the right food and what works for us, I think.
And we were lucky growing up, like you say, we were surrounded by food all the time from our grandmother, from our mothers, and it was a big part of growing up. It was never something that was not present in our lives, whether it was Diwali or a birthday or just a Sunday get-together. It was always centred around food, so we did always have food.
Yes, indeed, right? Yeah.
And tell us about Bombay. I mean, were you going back there quite a bit when you were younger? What sort of age did you... When do your memories date back to of Bombay?
I don't have a memory of when it does go back. So my earliest experience of Bombay, and I was told this by my father, was my first birthday was actually in one of these Irani cafes.
Oh.
So we were thrown out of what was then our home in Africa, and I was 6 months old, and my mum and I were stateless. We came along and came to Bombay, and I think my grandfather then had the foresight to have rented a small flat, and near that small flat was one of these cafes. That was my first birthday, and then eventually my father made sure that we were able to come to London, and then we settled here. And then since then, I remember with my grandmother and grandfather, they used to take me all around India. At the age of 6 or 7, I used to be sort of taken around on the train and in cars around India, and we used to eat everywhere and do everything. And so I've got lots and lots of childhood memories of the city and strolling up and down. And a lot of those memories are recounted in the book, in fact.
Yeah. And I guess for me, similarly, Bombay, for me, I strongly associate with my grandmother, our grandmother that we share. I spend a lot of time with my grandparents in Bombay. And the connection to Bombay for me was food as a youngster. So my grandparents used to quite often take me down to Bombay's Chowpatty Beach, which is where you get some fantastic food. And they used to leave me with the kulfi cellar, which sounds a bit weird now, whilst I used to go for a walk up and down the beach. And of course, you may not do that now, but back then when I was young, it was great. And unlimited ice cream.
Yeah, coffee on demand.
So Bombay for me goes back to our grandparents, but it was connected to food a lot.
And when you were in England as children growing up, what was the Indian food like then?
It was home food for us, I think. Yeah, yeah. And you know, we ate Indian food a lot at home, you know, as we've talked about.
And were you aware of the gulf between what you were eating at home compared to what was sort of being presented as Indian food to the English market
in curry houses?
Yeah,
yeah. I think we were, and I think the curry house is a great tradition. It's a real tradition, you know. It's Sylheti or Bengali people coming up early and opening restaurants. But the food is very Mughlai, and it's a specific kind of food. And the Mughlai food, I suppose, dates back to, you know, around the time of the 16th, 17th century, when there was a great flourishing of peace in India because of the Mughal Empire. And when peace happens, you get progress in arts and music and religion and so forth, and in food. And the food really developed. And I think that's almost the food that we get in Britain. The curry house food, it dates from that time. So it's a bit like, and maybe I'm being a bit unfair, as if we were going to go to India and we were going to go and eat the food of the 17th century. You know, you'd have sort of the courtly food of the 17th century.
like from Henry VIII's court.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, from King James's or King Charles's court. And I'm characterising a bit, obviously. So it is different. But then the British curry house is such a brilliant tradition because we've all grown up with it. You know, everyone's got the experience of going to their uni curry house and, you know, drinking lager and getting drunk and eating curry. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot more to be said about Indian food. It is a sort of fairly British thing. And in India, curry is not as omnipresent as it is over here. It's a sort of very different way of thinking about it.
And what do you think distinguishes sort of Bombay cuisine from other Indian cuisines?
I mean, Bombay cuisine is a bit of a mongrel, as is the city, and Bombay is a city which is really defined by its layers of accumulated difference. And Bombay is one of those cities that, I mean, the history of Bombay is that it was that there was a small settlement there, but then it was discovered by the Portuguese, who named it Bombeja, the Good Bay, which became Bombay, and then it was sold to King Charles, who was marrying Catherine of Braganza, and there was a sort of dowry that was given. Apparently she looked like a bat, and he had to be persuaded to marry her, and he eventually saw his way through to marrying her. But part of the way he saw his way through, part of the reason was that Bombay was given to him as a dowry, and so it became British then. But eventually, you know, people started settling there from all over India, all over the world, and it was a city that was, I think, motivated by commerce, about, you know, dreams of profit attracted different people from everywhere. And I think that all of that diversity came along. So there's people from all over India, people from all over the world, and the food scene totally reflects that. It really is a sort of mongrel city where you've got lots of South Indian food and North Indian food. And one of our favourite places in Bombay is called Baremia, which was opened by an immigrant, or a migrant, should I say, who left during partition, came from Lahore, you know, came from what is now Pakistan, and started a kebab stall. And now it's sort of Bombay's most famous sort of kebab place, and it takes over one of the streets in Colaba by night. And you see loads of cars around there, and people are eating off the hot bonnets of the cars. It's just delightful and brilliant. But Bombay basically takes in different foods of India. But then, and I think this is the beautiful trick that it pulls off, is that it makes them Bombay. It makes them its own. It sort of brings them in and gives them some sort of flavour, some sort of difference. And I think what I think we'd like to think we do is to bring you all that food, the Bombay comfort food, in the sort of, we try and find the best expression of a very real Bombay dish on our menu.
So you're having this incredible home-cooked food that is cooked lengthily and with care and with love. How is that comparing to, for example, what you're eating at school in England in your childhood?
I like school food.
I love school. That's good. I like school food. Yeah. So many people come and say, oh, the rice pudding. I think I love rice pudding.
Absolutely. You know what? I think when you prepare food with a lot of love, and certainly my experience of the people cooking for us at school, they really cared about it. They cared about giving us delicious, nutritious food. And I really enjoyed, like you said, school meals. So I think you can feel and taste the love when someone prepares that into the food that they're making. making for you. So for me, I saw a lot of parallels between that. Of course, we didn't always have Indian food at school every day, and we did at home. But I think it was joyous either way.
Let's talk about Dishoom. What kind of made you decide to start an Indian restaurant, but in such a kind of unique mould?
I think where it came from, and clearly there's a sort of food background for both of us, but the relationship between Britain and India goes back centuries. You know, clearly it's a long historical relationship. And I think the thing with long historical relationships, maybe for those of us who are married would get that as well, is that sometimes you think you know the other party in the relationship, but maybe you don't. And I think that Britain, you know, a lot of people might see India as a series of buckets, you know, Days of the Raj, Bollywood, cricket, Maharajas and palaces and sort of curry house might be the sort of five or six things. And there's so much more to it, that there is so much more that's very, very different. And even architecturally, when you go to Bombay, you see an awful lot of Gothic and an awful lot of Art Deco and an awful lot of brutalist architecture. It's not what we imagine of India. Our you know, vision might be in an incredible India advert, you would see Jaipur palaces. But I think that food-wise as well, there was so much to be said. And we felt that these Irani cafes that we spoke about, and I can talk about those, but it was a really good platform to be able to think again about food and think again about Bombay and refresh and recreate that relationship that Britain clearly has with India. And I think we couldn't do what we do without the curry houses. So I think there is an innate understanding of the flavours, but then to give people a very different version and say, hang on, this is what Bombay comfort food tastes like, was a really fun and interesting, sort of challenging thing to do.
And the Irani, I lived in Bombay for 6 months and used to work above Cafe Britannia.
Oh, brilliant.
And that's where I'd go and have lunch. Yeah.
Exactly. Mr.
Britannia and Co, exactly. Yeah. And they're beautiful, and you've obviously recreated that in your restaurants. I mean, the dishes seemed quite different to what I certainly kind of knew of as Indian food. I mean, were you sort of surprised that it was going to be so popular in the UK?
We were. I mean, and people started eating our food and sort of, I guess there's a few reactions. You do get some people coming in and saying, you know, where is the madras and where is the korma? and then you sort of politely have to say, we don't have that, but you might like this. And then other people who just took to it immediately were like, wow, these flavors are amazing. I think because the flavour palette is sort of familiar to the British, I think here it, you know, people could very readily accept it and start eating pao bhaji or start eating bel or start eating some of the things that we would serve which wouldn't normally be seen here.
The book follows a day in Bombay. It's, you know, it starts with breakfast and goes all the way through. Had you always intended Dishoom to be somewhere that wasn't just an evening restaurant? You know, you're so famous for your breakfasts as well as your dal and your evening food. Is that simply an Irani cafe influence from you, or was there any other reason why you wanted to be open for so long, serving so many meals?
I mean, people thought we were really idiots, and I think that back in they really were. But
you
back
have
in
to look at the queues outside your restaurant.
Well, now it's okay, of course. You know, it feels nice that it might have worked. But back in 2008 and 2009, when we were thinking about it, you know, there'd been the financial crash, and Lehman had crashed in 2008, and then we said, let's start a restaurant, which seemed not to be a good idea. And then someone would say, what sort of restaurant? And we'd be like, an Indian restaurant. And like, it's, and then they'd say, well, what about it? So it's going to do breakfast. And of course, by that time, they'd write you off as some sort of village idiot.
Lunatic, yeah.
And truth be told, when we launched it, it took us a couple of years of Covey and I sitting around with Chef looking at a, you know, bacon naan roll and wondering if anyone was going to come in and thinking the chai was quite nice, but it's not very hot anymore. But I guess the spur was that these Irani cafes were all-day places and we wanted this to be that. And I think also, I mean, talking about curry houses, if I'm very honest as well, we had a feeling that if you did breakfast, a curry house could not possibly do breakfast, so this could not possibly be a curry house. And we wanted not to be that. We were in such a different tradition. Yeah. Mm. And it was a cafe tradition. And a cafe tradition is about all day. It's about people coming in. It's about different types of people. And you know, we have great respect for Jeremy King, for example, and the Wolseley and so forth. And I like to think of the Irani cafes in some ways as a sort of poor man's version of a grand cafe. And indeed they were, because at that stage when the Iranis were setting up these cafes, their predominant sort of aspiration would be European. And indeed a lot of the chairs and the furniture were from Czechoslovakia and Austria. So there is that little bit of grand cafe DNA in what we do in a very sort of poor man's sort of small way. So cafe and clatter and buzz and people together was interesting, and therefore breakfast was pretty important.
And how did you come up with the menu for Dishoom?
It's really our version of the best of Bombay's comfort food. It takes the things that people really enjoy eating in the city, whether it is Baam Bhaji on the beach or the street grills at Bada Mia or Vada Pav outside Kirti College. It's all of these fantastic things that people really eat in the city. And we thought, well, why don't we bring that? Because you get all those things in Bombay, but you don't actually get them all in one place. So for us, it was a real delight to be able to share all those things on our table together. And the heritage of them are so different. A vada pav on the street is very different to a lamb ram, which has got really Muslim traditions, alongside a baum bhaji, which is a mash of vegetables with hot bread that was originally used to feed cotton mill workers. So for us, those things are so different, but they exist in the city that we love exploring and sharing. To bring those things all together on a single table was really fun for us. And I think that all of those things on the menu that people really can relate to have stood the test of time in their own way in Bombay. So whether you're familiar with the food or not, it has lasted a long time because it's a real thing and people enjoy eating it for what it is. And so for us, we always try really hard to make sure that when you do eat in one of our restaurants, it does take you back to that best version of itself in Bombay.
And you mentioned the different influences from the different areas in Bombay there, and inclusivity is a big part of the Dishoom culture. You celebrate all the different religious festivals, is that right?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I think it's very important to us to do so. We started doing it in a small way, but one year we received a piece of hate mail, and I remember that letter. It was an email from someone, and it was very articulate. It was well written. It was obviously somebody, you know, reasonably educated, and he had seen some pictures of Muslim children celebrating Eid on our website, because we were celebrating Eid, and our chef is Muslim, and we're sort of into all that. And he wrote a very threatening email saying, you know, I hope your wives and sisters and you know, daughters have to do this in front of these people and so forth. And obviously we were pretty upset about it. But then we sort of took it as a spur to do more. And I remember that at one of our Eid festivals, we had had a tweet. I'd seen a tweet, a girl called Sarah, a girl called Aisha, and a girl called...
Gita.
So sorry.
Gita.
Gita, exactly. A Hindu, a Christian, and a Muslim had done mendi on their hands. And it was the polar opposite of this hate mail. It was people celebrating each other's differences. It was brilliant. And so we really doubled down on that. And we said, right, we're going to go big on Diwali. We're going to go big on Eid. We're going to do Christmas carols, because I love a good caroling. So we do a big Christmas carol. And we serve sort of spice, mulled wine, and mint spies at our Christmas carols. But the Eid is great, because we take over Dinorama, which is a sort of super hip space in Shoreditch. And it's we turn it halal. We turn it non-alcohol free. And I think about 1,000 people came. And I reckon half of those are probably not Muslim. So it's a great thing. And I think for societies like ours, which have lots of people in them, for us to celebrate each other's differences and are all enveloped in this sort of London culture or our culture here in this country, is just brilliant. That's what we need more of.
Mm. Can you tell us a bit about the jazz? Because I know that it's a big part of the Dishoom brand. And is that something that's obviously big in Bombay?
Well, it isn't really anymore, but it was. So in the 30s and the 40s, it was a big deal in Bombay. And you had American musicians, black American musicians, who had played with Coleman Hawkins and Louis Armstrong appearing in the city. And a lot of them took up residence in the Taj Hotel and started playing this jazz. And initially, I think they had to play it at a slower tempo because people in Bombay just didn't get it. And apparently you can't dance jazz in a sari, so I hear. So not that I know, I haven't tried that. But it became a really, really big deal in Bombay. And for us to have discovered that was a big deal. A good friend of ours is a guy called Naresh Fernandez, who wrote the book called Taj Mahal Foxtrot. And it describes in loving detail that jazz scene in all of its color and all the local musicians who indeed later emerged. And that sound actually, interestingly, became really the sound of a new nation as well. So jazz was adopted as the sound of early Bollywood as well. So you get a lot of the early films where these great screaming jazz soundtracks. So it was quite a sort of almost slightly nationalistic. I mean, really interesting. But a few years ago, we turned the story of that sort of jazz scene and taking the elements of Art Deco architecture into the basis for a restaurant. So the restaurant in Kensington, which is in the Barker's building, which is a beautiful old Art Deco building and you know, very listed and protected. We're fortunate to have a restaurant in there, but it's designed on the basis of all the Art Deco architecture in Bombay, but also the jazz scene in Bombay. And we wrote a story about a man called Cyrus Irani, who is a sort of cross between Carlito from Carlito's Way and Rick from Casablanca, who is he maybe went to prison but has some money and comes out of prison, and he buys an old Art Deco cinema and turns it into a jazz club restaurant. And then the police come back and get him. And in fact, we launched an immersive theatre production in that restaurant that time. So for the first couple of weeks, you didn't come to the restaurant. You came to the immersive theatre production. You came to the opening night of a place called the Bombay Roxy in 1948. So we are obsessed. Well, I am obsessed. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, we are. And actually, we still have in Kensington, in that beautiful deco restaurant, jazz 3 nights a week. So we have a live jazz band up on the mezzanine, which is really fun.
And I'm just delighted that I found a way to smuggle my interest into a restaurant business. Well, yeah,
that leads us perfectly into my favourite subject about dishing, which is that each of the seven restaurants has a different founding story, a different founding myth. Where did that idea come from to do that? And then how do you choose your different stories for your restaurants?
I mean, initially we didn't do it. The first restaurant, we didn't do it. And the second restaurant, I sort of had an idea to write something. And it was just an idea to think about a physical Irani cafe shuffling into an old space in East London in Shoreditch and leaving its sort of dirty corners there in Shoreditch. And we wrote that. And then by the time we got to the next restaurant, we decided to develop it into more of a story and didn't really... think about it too much, but started writing, and then decided to write to create the design. And I remember that story is because that restaurant is in an old goods shed, so it's in the King's Cross area, the historical area. So it's a goods shed from the 1860s, and because it's near King's Cross Station, St Pancras Station actually, which is a close relative of VT Station in Bombay, they're both sort of Gothic, big Gothic stations. So we imagined a young Irani fed up on the platform late, you know, the train's late, which they never were, but the train's late. He wanders into this big goods shed around the back of Victoria Terminus, and he sees men and machines and commerce and stuff moving around as if it's in the King's Cross shed. And he says, there's an opportunity here. And he says, well, I can sell some chai. So he sets up a chai stall and it does well. And then a week later, he bribes the guards and he sets up a sort of little kitchen. And eventually he bribes them some more, sets up a sort of bit more. And in our imagination, the conceit is, I suppose, that he takes over the whole goods shed.
And it's huge.
In the next sort of 20 years. And the predominant events between 1928, when we imagine the story happening, and 1948, when we sort of finish the story in Indian independence. And I'm also a history nut, you know, so I'm really interested in the events of that period. So all the details in that restaurant are picked off from that period. So that there's a set of rules along which reference all the major events. We got in touch with a lady called Homai Virawala, who was India's first female photojournalist and a Parsi, and then put her pictures of the events of Indian independence around the restaurant and so forth. So it was really good fun to sort of create history in a very living space, and then use that to create a restaurant design. And at the same time, we researched all the Bombay architecture of that period, went to all the buildings, including the Western Railway offices and the old goods shed, Mukesh Mills, which no one goes to, and then brought all of those visual and architectural ideas into that narrative. And I love the idea of design as sort of story.
Is it true that in the entrance of the Carnaby Street restaurant, you changed the screw heads?
That is true, so they properly reflect
what would have been there in the
1960s. And that restaurant's based on the rock scene in Bombay of the 60s, which I could talk about as well. We did change the screw heads there, yeah.
And you've set up, as Livy says, seven restaurants. I mean, what have you learned about the world of restaurants? What advice would you give to people listening who are interested in doing the same?
Go on, you first.
What advice would we give them? Don't do it. It's a real joy, but I think it's a real challenge. It's not an easy industry, and restaurants are something that we can all relate to. And we all have different stories and journeys with food, and we all have different inspirations. But for us, what we love doing is sharing our stories through the design, through the way that we research the food, through the way we cook it. But I think people that want to do this, I think, have to love the fact that they're going to be looking after people, because I don't think we could do anything that we do in our business without having a fantastic team around us. So I think that is really, really important to understand that this isn't a one-man band or a two-man band or three. This is a lot of people who really want to look after those people that are coming to eat with them. And so I think my one piece of advice is go work in somebody else's restaurant and then really think about the team that are going to help you deliver your promise that you're trying to make your guests.
I think that's right. I think I've got a specific thing. I think that, I mean, but both of us are from professional backgrounds, and my background was, you know, management consulting for a while. And I think when you leave something like that, you always leave with a little template in your head which talks about revenue and cost and profit. And of course, you hear that restaurants should be about profit. And I think we thought that, but I don't think that's the right focus. I think if I was advising a budding restaurateur, I would say that, in fact, I remember one review we had when we were doing a pop-up on the South Bank. And I think it's just too rude to repeat on a podcast, but I might do it anyway. You can edit it out. But I remember once we ran out of something, the tandoor broke.
Yeah.
And we had a product that, you know, it was a naan roll. It was very good, I think, and we couldn't make it. So somebody made the decision to start serving that same thing on burger buns, and it was a terrible product. And at least we got cash in the till. I think that was probably the motivation. And the next day I read a review, and the caption on the review, there was a picture of aforementioned bun, and then the caption was, Frankie went to Bollywood and shat in a bun. And I was right.
That's
I was mortified. Wow. I was just, you know, just fell over. And like,
brutal,
oh my God.
Brutal, but fair.
Well, and very helpful.
Yeah, totally helpful.
Because I think that, I think the profit focus is a tricky one. You've got to be very careful. And I think gradually we moved to being very focused on making sure, this is going to sound very trite, but to making sure that you're focusing on awesome food and drink, awesome service and a happy team. Then you can control cost, and the revenue and the profit are the applause that follow. And I think that our business changed once we made that change. And it was really uninstalling whatever software I'd accumulated from management consulting and just reframing that. And of course, profit's important because you need it to survive, but that's not how you make money.
Mm. I mean, you guys always have a queue outside. I mean, what do you think is the secret to that? Is that word of mouth, or everyone? Are you in lots of guidebooks now?
It's the crack that Gobby sneaks into the black bar.
Don't tell everyone.
That was it.
Well, there was a rumour, this is a tangent, but in the 1890s, there was a rumour that the reason that chai from Irani cafes was so addictive was because they put opium in it. Yeah.
I like that you said that they'd never do that for profit reasons.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
That doesn't make sense. Yeah. Opium at the price of chai.
Which is why I can assure you there's no
crack
in the bar.
I was going to ask you what the secret is to good chai.
Now you know.
Yes. So there are a lot of, cult dishes on your menu that people have really taken to their hearts. So, I mean, the bacon naan is synonymous
and the
with
double
dishes.
Bacon naan.
The yes. The the black dal, the Ruby Murray. Do you have a favourite menu item?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think, other than breakfast, you can eat a standalone item on our menu. What I do love about our food is that you get it, and it's like being at home. There's so much food on the table that you get to enjoy a little bit of everything. Yeah.
It's like being in our home when we were young.
There's just lots of food for everyone to enjoy. And I think the joy for me of eating at Dishoom with friends or family is to explore and lean over somebody and kind of grab that and try it with something else. And I can't put my finger on one favourite dish, but I do love the feeling of kind of devouring it all.
I think that's completely true. And I would agree with that. I mean, the dal is something that's really special for me, and I love the simplicity of it. There aren't many ingredients in it, and it's not an easy process, but just the sheer simplicity and sort of taste of it is just delicious. And if I can relate Miles Davis to a pot of black dal, but Miles Davis said it's you know, the notes that you don't play are as important as the notes that you do. And I'm no musician, but I think in the dal, all the stuff that isn't in there is really important because it's such a simple and pure dish.
And what about at home nowadays? And what do you like to cook for your families?
Well, we've got a book full of 100 delicious recipes. I've got to make my way through that now. That's a really hard question. What do I cook for my families? I really love cooking. I've got 3 young children, one who's very little, but we just like to cook home-style food. My wife is Lebanese, so we end up with a lot of Lebanese food. We do occasionally try to make some of the Indian food here, but we like to explore with them. The kids, they're young, they like to learn about new things. Their mum's a nutritional therapist, so she's really big into understanding what's good for them as children as well. So for us, food is really important at home, and I think it's for children about having a healthy connection with that and not having these adversities to food or not disliking things and trying everything once. And for us, it's that journey about teaching them that this is a really important part of who they're going to be growing up. And so, don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, it does.
It's a bit of everything.
Well, we've recently got the simple book by Ottolenghi, which is really simple. It's nice. So we've been eating whole heads of cauliflower, which is nice. We also discovered the green roasting tin book.
It's
really very good, and it's because it's obviously hard to find too much time to cook, but it is. It's really quick and easy.
Well,
and
there's
delicious.
Now the quick roasting tin.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, it's even quicker.
Brilliant.
So it's quite a very practical book to cook from at home.
So tell us what the next step is for Dishoom.
I think for us, we're not focused on any aggressive growth plans. I mean, I think that the restaurant industry is famously, you know, struggling at the moment in some ways, you know, in other ways it's not. But I think for us, it's about being very steady and thoughtful about what we do. I personally love to find ways to sneak in more of my sort of crazy interests, whether it's immersive theatre or jazz or, you know, the Bombay rock scene in the 1960s into Dishoom. So I'm always plotting, and Covey is holding me back from
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly.
But it takes us so long to open and to research and think about a restaurant that we just can't do that many of them. And I think it's a very healthy bottleneck that it sort of slows us down. So you know, we will open more restaurants, but only to the extent that we can make sure that they're even better than the last one. So we have a sort of mantra in the business, which is deepen, don't dilute. So we sort of think about everything we do, whether it's a meal we serve or whether it's a restaurant we design, should be better than the last one that we did. And I think that just slows you down. So we'll be progressing slowly.
Well, Shamil and Kavi, thank you so much for joining us. And anyone who wants to get a copy of Dishoom from Bombay with Love, it's now available in all good bookshops.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon céleste.